like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Colleen Plum, the Chicago-based artist, photographer, and videographer whose work explores the relationships people have with animals, relationships she deems contradictory. Her work has been widely exhibited, but some of her most striking work may not have been displayed in a museum at all, like 30 times a minute, a reference to the resting heart rate of an elephant. This piece involves footage she's filmed of elephants at zoos, exhibiting stereotypy, a behavior only seen in captive animals, most notably rhythmic rocking, head bobbing, and pacing, etc., and which she's projected over 100 times on the outside of buildings across this country and internationally, including in Berlin, Paris, and Reykjavik. We'll explore the questions and issues underpinning her work, the genesis of 30 times a minute, and her experiences presenting the piece, including conversations with bystanders who are watching when I speak with Colleen Plum in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, the entomologist who's been on the show twice before, discussing her series of books about ants and more recently a book she co-wrote about spiders. I was struck by Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story entitled "The Insect Apocalypse Is Here," an extended examination of the seemingly drastic decline in the number of bugs worldwide, and asked Dr. Spicer Rice to spend a few moments weighing in on the piece. She'll do so a bit later in the program. Right now, though, let's speak with Colleen with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Colleen Plum on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. So it feels like your story involves at least two major narratives, photographer making art, later doing so with video as well, and animal advocate. And somewhere along the line, those storylines sort of intertwined. So I'm really interested in learning about all those elements over the course of our conversation this morning. First of all, though, growing up, how did you feel about animals? What role did they play in your family?
Well, I grew up in Rogers Park in Chicago, and it's a pretty urban neighborhood. So we always had a dog, and my dad was really into going canoeing in the local, you know, rivers, wherever we could find nature around mm-hmm. here. And I think he really instilled some to notice, I guess,
okay.
notice the nature around us. And, you know, he was really an influence that way. We would pause. You know, we'd go skiing, like in Wisconsin, and say thanks, you know,
right.
for the view or for the. And we had a pet duck, which was kind of funny.
A pet duck? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how did that come about? Because you don't hear that every day.
You know what? My dad brought him home. We named him Sir Francis Drake.
Of course. What else could you call a pet duck, really?
I know. Yeah. You know, I don't even remember where he came from. Isn't that funny?
Wow.
That's my dad.
Apart from Sir Francis Drake, it sounds like there was always a dog in the picture.
Yeah.
And then obviously an appreciation for nature when you guys were out and about, just canoeing, hiking, whatever you were doing. That was kind of the way you grew up. So obviously animals and nature and everything were saluted and felt positive about.
Yeah. And I mean, minimally, I feel like it was really minimal. There was sort of this longing. I think that kind of, if you could analyze my work, this interest is sort of this missing element of where can we connect with animals and how do we connect with animals? And even just that exploration that I began into that, you know, what sort of role does artists play? And is that a satisfying way to experience? You know, you go to some restaurant that's this themed or whatever, and it's so bizarre that people do this. And is it out of lack? Or, you know, what is the impulse to connect with animals when you're sort of not around them as we had been in early human you know, time.
Well, that's really interesting, especially because in your case, although it was sounds like limited largely to maybe one dog at a time and then for a period, a duck, which is, again, unusual. But again, to compare to some people I've spoken on the show, even just last week, the guy who kind of created and produced that dogs documentary on Netflix, you might have heard about or maybe even have seen. I'm always interested in how people that are involved with animals in one way or another grew up, partly for that reason, because like he, animals, pets, whatever, were totally verboten in his household growing up. Wow. And so in some ways, from what you've just said now, I'd almost have expected that to be your story when you're talking about a longing and sort of what was maybe propelling your artistic impulses, because it sounds like it's like, hey, I have a longing for animals and a desire to connect with them, but you weren't deprived of animals in your formative years.
No, and I think that connection, I mean, there's the question of domestication and how animals become part of our family, and that is so beautiful, and that where did it go awry? You know, that's what my work now is all about. Like, what happened here? Why do we then exploit animals so deeply through history? I think that, you know, the early connection to animals, and my sister was really, she was really, really attached to our dog, and then he died. I remember that was such a sad thing in our family that our dog died, and I mean, as it is in every family, but
sure,
that they're members, you know.
Right.
And then this complete contradiction of how we actually treat and as, you know, people eating animals or wearing them, and that
it or holding them captive.
Yeah, and yeah. What is normalized, and that's really how we've been programmed to believe that this is okay. And, you know, we can look at these animals this way, but other animals have to be for our use or locked up. I mean, there was this really small zoo at Indian Boundary, and it was pathetic, but we didn't even see it as pathetic almost. You just almost don't realize until you think deeper. I think that's fascinating about how we've been programmed and what's been normalized through history.
So then where would you mark where you started to really have what sounds like that sort of revelation yourself? I mean, again, growing up, there was at least some animal action and, again, appreciation of animals or at least nature more generally. So where along that path did you say, wait, hold on, this doesn't make sense to me?
I think it was through my photography project. It was a series called Animals Are Outside Today. And it really did start out rather innocently, this looking at how we're animals and humans are woven together, and again, looking at artifice. And then I started to go deeper in that project, and it taught me, you know, once you start going to, I went to a meatpacker, I went to this fur shop, you know, I realized the main and pretty much primary way that we experience animals is through using them and exploiting them. And so when I went to the circus, and I went to the Ringling Circus to photograph for that series, and I saw, I was out in the parking lot, and it was disturbing. It planted a really big seed in my thinking, because I saw the elephants walking through the parking lot, and it was freezing. It was November, and, you know, the Chicago wind was so, I remember just my fingers were freezing, and seeing these elephants come out of the United Center after their performance and walk through the parking lot in this desolate area, and thinking, that is just really sad. These elephants, that you could hear them walking past, their giant, massive bodies walking past. And then I started my project that was to look at captive elephants. That was the moment I thought, I need to do a project about the lives of captive elephants. And that's when it started. And that's, I think, when I really became much more activist-minded. And it really, you know, the more you see, the more I would see, the more I would become bothered about injustice towards these creatures, that they care about their life just as much as we do. You know, I came to realize that.
Okay, so what I want to do is hold that thought or hold that part of the storyline for a sec, because I think we might have skipped over something where I want to go back a little bit. But
sure.
But in fact, let me start the more effectively the other, what I at least imagine is parallel storyline, which is you taking pictures. So when did you start taking photos? Was that something you did as a kid, or how early on was that?
You know, I had one of those sort of, it was this like Bell and Howell, like pocket camera in the 80s. I remember this button at the top, it would snap, and I would take pictures a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I had a photo album with like this, mountain scene on the front and like the cellophane pages. And I really liked, you know, documenting my
work. And how old were you when you got the Bell and Howell, started taking those kind of pictures?
I was probably like 12, 11
okay.
or 12.
Yeah.
But, and my grandfather was, he always had cameras
okay.
and lenses, and you know, it was a big production at holidays. But I didn't get into it because in college I was a graphic designer, you know, I got a graphic design degree, but I did take photography classes, and that was really exciting to be
yeah.
in the dark room and to make images. And I didn't have any specific theme to the work at that time at all. I
yeah.
just, you know, learning. And then after I had a job for a while, I thought I would like to go back to grad school to pursue photography because I loved it so much in
yeah.
In undergrad. And then that's where the serious study at photography. But I think that I've always been, you know, I would look at a lot of photojournalism, I think, influenced me in the early days where I would look at Life magazine or anything that was documenting the world. I just would eat it up. I
yeah.
remember being so interested in how the role of photography in life, I guess.
Okay, because that fills in some key gaps. And so, because when you said a few moments ago that sort of as an expression of like thinking about that longing, have that revelation about how we were thinking about and treating animals, you did the animals are outside thing, but it seems like there would have been some sort of prelude to that, like you wouldn't just go to that kind of project without something preceding that, just even in your overall thinking or in your day-to-day life or some aspect. So
it happened really organically, I think.
Yeah.
In graduate school I was I had my dog Ethel. We would go out. I was photographing constantly. I say we. She was my assistant.
Well, she was your photo assistant, I guess, but probably not snapping that many shots. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But she was great. I mean, this was in the 90s and you didn't need leashes. No one really paid attention.
Ah, okay.
She was the lab and she was off leash and she would come around with me and I would just, the world kind of came alive with that.
Yeah.
With early graduate school and just making pictures and figuring, it was challenging because I didn't know what I wanted to focus on. I mean, I was really lost, frankly. And then I would bring these pictures into class and we'd have critiques and there were always animals. There were always artificial representations of animals. And that became, it sort of revealed itself to me that I was looking at this idea of bizarre, this contradiction of there's a plastic flamingo on this in this alley, and that is sort of funny to me. It didn't make sense. It was what I started to notice, I guess, in my picture making. And then I became, once you notice what you're doing, then you do it way more consciously. You know, I set out to really explore this. How do we, I would go to restaurants that had these artificial things, and then one thing kept leading to another. It was really just a lot of research, like, oh, what is this? How else do we have animals? I would go to museums, you know, the more obvious ways, just through natural history museums or even the zoo. I would go and try to just do this examination or our clothing, anything. You know, I would always have my camera with me and notice constantly. I mean, once you start looking, it's like, wow, the representations of animals are everywhere and that we've sort of co-opted their symbolism into our culture.
But
that was really interesting.
And so it sounds like that even before you had any kind of particular, let's say, guiding principle or even sensibility, that you were just kind of following a path that really, generally speaking, involved animals, exploring animals and thinking about animals. And that's where you would go with your camera, often with Ethel in tow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really, I think that it's kind of funny how the project has taught me there's some sort of connection to maybe, well, for me, it's like animals bring me to a place of reality in a way that is sometimes missing, you know, in life or society or in an urban place. And, you know, but again, once you see what that idea of taking an animal and what it can give to us, that connection to maybe ourselves or
yeah.
something deeper, then I've realized how it's just gone haywire and it's to their detriment.
So it sounds like in a way that in those early on, just out there shooting and sort of discovering odd and interesting images, that the flamingo, et cetera, that you didn't necessarily have anything particular at that moment that you wanted to articulate. You wanted to kind of just sort of keep going down a path that maybe you weren't quite sure where it would lead. Whereas obviously later you had very specific ideas, it seems like, about captivity and other things that you
yep.
set out to articulate with your work.
Yes, it taught me. I think that the pictures in the Animals Are Outside Today book are a survey, and definitely I was getting there. I mean, really getting there with the series where I was saying, now this doesn't, I didn't want to have a real negative view. I wanted to keep it observational and bring the fact. I'll just bring that contradiction, and maybe that can get people to think a little bit more. But, and there was, you know, a lot of dead animals, like how we find them. We don't really see them in their real, in the real way. We see them through, you know, a museum as a taxidermied animal that's been killed, or through their carcass.
Yeah.
We will find them. And that it was, it's all sort of through this disconnected way of seeing them.
Right.
But so I was getting there. And in 2010, when it was winding down, I went to the oil spill in Louisiana, and that was, I just felt this intense need to include something from that tragedy, the Deep Horizon one.
Mm-hmm, sure.
In the series as a mark. And I found, I didn't want to, you know, there were lots of news pictures of oiled birds. And I thought, when I was down there, I was really like, what am I doing here? I don't even know what I'll find. And it was really difficult, actually. You know, you didn't have access. It was very monitored by the military. So I felt like you couldn't go to the beach or anything. But I did find I got really lucky. It was just, I found the Audubon Center for, it was called ACRE, Audubon Center for Rehabilitation. And they were a fish and wildlife guy was turning in a sea turtle that he had been oiled and was killed. And he pulled up as they weren't letting me in.
Okay.
Like he had this evidence, and I photographed this bag that contained the sea turtle. And to me, that marked this tragedy. Because here's a sea turtle being turned in as evidence, and he's in this plastic white bag, and just this shroudedness of it all,
mm-hmm.
loss, and just our impact on the land and on the animals there, and how awful, and that it's still continuing. I mean, obviously, we're really in trouble.
Yeah. Well, also, I would think, too, that as horrific as that was, I mean, I wouldn't say got accustomed to, but it was not uncommon to see images of birds coated in oil in the wake of Deep Horizon. But as you're suggesting, the idea that here's a sea turtle that's a victim of that just seems like it would be much more profound and jarring.
Yeah, that was my hope. And when I found it, and his name was Greg Goodall, Greg Godspeed, the ranger.
Yeah.
And I was like, can I photograph that? And I just thought, that's why I'm here. Is to get this picture. It just felt really like the reason, and just what you said. It's just really tragic, and to try to talk about it in a symbolic, larger way.
Yeah. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Colleen Plum, an artist, photographer, and videographer whose work explores the relationships people have with animals, often focusing on issues surrounding captivity. If you'd like to ask Colleen a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. And if you're online at the moment and want to see her work while listening to the conversation, her website is Colleen Plum, C-O-L-L, two L's, two E's, Colleen Plum with a B, .com. And you can check out some of her work and images as we continue our conversation. In fact, let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Colleen Plum.
Yeah, I just want to thank Duncan for having Colleen on. This kind of activism and education seems to be one of the only things that works these days, because most people now don't seem to read books, and they don't listen to progressive media, and they don't go to animal rights and animal suffering websites, but they do like visuals. Like the movie Zootopia, for example, did a lot to educate people about how animals are and the difference between predator and prey. But what you're touching on in your work is the sad fact of the human species, is that we are the ultimate dominator with a vertical hierarchy. And really, we view the entire planet as our zoo, where we can do whatever we want to all the animals and their habitats. And I see most human relationship with animals, including the helper dog movement, etc., as a vertical dominator relationship without any egalitarianism. The animals can never consent. Zoos, of course, are a part of it. Vivisection is terrible. Eating animals is terrible. But we just do that to anything that's weaker than ourselves, and animals have been presented as being on this planet for us to do whatever we want to. So you're fighting a rising tide of human selfishness and cruelty. One last thing I want to say. Be careful when you're out there doing what essentially amounts to photojournalism. Many animal abusers do not like to have themselves exposed, and these people will, I've had it happen to me, taking pictures of fishermen on the beach beating up rays and other things that they've pulled out with their hook. They don't like their cruelty to be seen, but keep up the great work, and thank you so much.
Thank you, caller. Any responses, Colleen, to our caller's comments?
Well, that's a great comment, and I completely agree with that. We're just human supremacy reigns, and it's that's, he just articulated it so well, and I try to, and I also really appreciate that he thinks I'm going about it in a good way, because there's lots of ways to go about activism and raising awareness, you know, and the way I'm doing it is to show, you know, if I'm doing this work and I'm projecting and showing what I found, then let people decide, and not in a horrifying way, but just a factual, like, this is what we have done, and talk about it. If we can just talk about this, then there's, you know, zoos are not educate. We'll talk about zoos, but they're not educating, as they say. They're sort of sugarcoating and myth-making, and we need to be more straightforward and teach kids this is not normal. You know, and stop breeding and stop dominating. And I mean, it's just almost like this. There's many ways to analyze it, too, of where this comes from, this desire to have power. We have the weapons to dominate animals and catch them and kill them. And does that come from our insecurity? We don't have the power that animals have. So I find that really interesting, of why we've kind of gone down this severe interest in domination and holding power and killing and showing our, look what we can do. It's not a good, you know, humans, I think I try not to get too down on it, that maybe we're getting progressing, and maybe we're waking up and saying, oh, this isn't working.
Well, so with that in mind, let's sort of pick up the story from going down to the Deep Horizon spill and capturing the image of that sea turtle. So was that what you would mark as sort of a pivotal point at which you started to maybe, because it sounds like really up to that point, maybe even a little bit beyond, you were kind of following a muse that you couldn't even quite specify or identify or articulate, but you just knew you had to keep going, and you had to go down to the oil spill, and you had to look around, and then found the sea turtle. So it sounds like you were just on a journey that wasn't quite clear to you, but you just knew you had to keep going.
Yeah, I think that, I think all along, it's kind of like you just know, if say you visit a zoo, you know this is wrong. We know, we see this. This doesn't add up. And I felt that way with all of them. I mean, I went to Central Park Zoo. I think that was one that I knew I needed to include because of that utter contradiction. I mean, a polar bear, there aren't any polar bears in Central Park Zoo anymore, but they've died.
Yeah.
But, you know, what is a polar bear doing in the middle of New York City? So it kept building. I do think that as I was going, but I never wanted to fully commit to saying, no, we can't, you know, because I had this idea that an artist needs to just stay sort of neutral, and which I do think, you know, I struggle with that all the time, like over who am I? And I think I've just let go of that. Like, I'm just making this work, and it can do work. It can speak.
Well, with that in mind, then, when do you think, when would you mark like a shift in what might have earlier on, like around grad school or a little beyond, or more of a photojournalism emphasis? When do you think it kind of spun into more of a focus on, hey, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to make it more of an artistic kind of expression?
Well, I think when you mean when I became more activist minded?
Well, or just when you took what was maybe more just shooting kind of representations in the photojournalism realm and said, here, I'm going to have some sort of artistic purpose behind what I do, maybe more than what I had been doing in some of the grad school or other efforts.
Well, I think all along I was viewing this as fine art photography, as making strong compositions and pictures with this theme. I think it was not really photojournalism. That definitely is, or documentary.
Okay.
You could call it documentary because I'm documenting what I'm finding. But, you know, there was always this concept that got stronger and stronger. And I think the turning point to getting much more of this is outrageous was toward the end of that series of the Animals Outside Today, when I went to these, you know, I thought, what's missing? The oil spill happened. And then the circus. I mean, the circus was a huge turning point where I saw the elephants and I thought, all right, now this is finished. I'm almost finished with this work. What can I do next? And I thought, let's do one animal, and it was, you know, this iconic elephant that represents so much of the history of America or of the world, and let's look at that and see what we can find. And then I started to go to all of the zoos and see what was going on there.
And was the idea when you started hitting the zoos that you would, I mean, had you already kind of shifted or broadened from photography to videography at that moment, or?
Well, yeah, it was right at the time when I thought I want to do a video project.
Okay.
And I'm self-taught. I did not, I don't know where that impulse came from, but I think I just thought, all right, I just want to make moving images. I think it was just to change, make it, do something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And think about the moving image. How can the moving image work? And so I was experimenting. So after the circus, that seeing those animals in the parking lot,
yeah,
I took this road trip and I went with my kids. I thought let's explore where the elephants all live from here to South Carolina. And I took the trip and I went, you know, we passed all of the zoos, not to visit them and not to sort of gawk at them, but to examine what is their space, what do they look like, what are they doing. And I made loads of horrible video because it was all shaky. And and then when I got to Greenville, South Carolina, that's where I saw Joy, this elephant. She was rocking in nonstop. She was just making this massive swaying her body. And I held the video, I had a tripod and I held it steady, and I got a long clip of her rocking. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what that was. I mean, that was where it started. I saw her doing this stereotypic behavior, that's what I learned it was like. But after that trip, I came home and I set off to go to 75 more zoos.
Wow.
Because I wanted to find out who else was doing this. What other elephants? How are they doing this? And when I found at every zoo, there was at least one doing this. So it was collecting the footage.
So the idea was, when you set out for the 75 more, it was like, how many other elephants are having the experience that Joy is having?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't mean to do 75. You know, I just kept going because then it became this idea of multiplicity. And if I have so much footage that's undeniable, that zoos, that their life in captivity, and through loads of research from experts and biologists about what that behavior is exhibiting, and that, I mean, it was really heartbreaking to go over and over, but I felt like I needed to see them and to prove that they were there.
Yeah.
They were doing this.
So when, over the course of those 75 zoo visits and capturing those elephants on those videos, when did you start to know what that would become?
I all along I thought, what am I going to do with all of this footage, and should I edit it, and how long should this video be? And in 2014 I had put together it was about a 20-minute loop where they were woven together.
Uh-huh.
And I showed it to I was having a show in Miami, and it was at Dina Matrani Gallery, and her sister had next door the screening room, and it was a video gallery. So I had a show of photographs and video in the video, and Rhonda Matrani, she was really the first say, this is really something. And she gave me some feedback about the length, you know, and I shortened it up a little bit. I tightened it up and I had that show. And that's the first time I was able to exhibit it and see the reaction from people.
Yeah.
Some people were really, you know, you go into this dark space and this projection of these elephants are there. And there was an audio component that references how elephants communicate through what's called infrasonic sound. You probably know this, but we can't hear it. It's too low for our ears. And so I wanted the audio to have this low bass that you could feel. And so you go into this dark space and see this, and they rock, and it becomes kind of this meditation into, and hopefully not too horrifying. Like, for some people, it's really horrifying. They don't want to watch it because they know it's suffering. But other people, you know, you watch it, and suddenly, what does that mean? What does it mean to bear witness to their suffering? And so that was the first time. And I thought, all right, now I'm onto something. This is, I can, you know, do more with this video. And then I started to project them outside.
Well, that to me is, again, where it becomes yet again something different. So in that museum / screening room in Miami was really the first showing of, was it then called 30 Times a Minute, or did you title it subsequently?
I think I titled it after that because I was calling it Weaving.
Okay.
And because that's another term for the stereotypic,
stereotypy, yeah.
Weaving. So it was after that. I called it Warp of the Longitudes. That's how projects evolve for me.
Okay.
So you land on the right.
Yeah.
I think it was Warp of the Longitudes originally.
Okay.
And so it was kind of a long title. So I changed, it's like it evolved to 30 Times a Minute.
Which we should point out is a reference to, why don't you say?
Yeah, the heart rate, the resting heart rate of an elephant. And so the reason I titled it, I found circus owners. People would say, why is the elephant rocking? you know, they'd be at the circus. And this is just anecdotal. I found something of this on on Google, you know, that the circus owners would tell people that they must rock, that this is keeping to their heartbeat. So it's, again, it's this how things are delivered to us. And it's a lie.
Yeah.
They were not doing it out of necessity to keep with their heartbeat to rest.
Yeah.
They were doing it because they usually walk 30 miles a day and they're chained up. So they're rocking. I call it a wish walk, where they're just, could we please? You know, they're doing it to soothe themselves. You know, other animals do. Tigers pace, bears pace. Animals that are far roaming have no business in captivity because they normally would be walking far.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me, every year since I began the show, I would always do at least one sort of show strictly devoted to ringling, tied to when ringling was coming through town. So one year I convened this whole panel discussion with all these experts and journalists, and I decided, okay, I really should have somebody from ringling to be part of this. So I got their kind of main circus spokesman, very smooth, eloquent guy. So at one point people were talking about the way, even when they would invite people to come see the elephants before the show, just to show them how great their lives were, and they would talk about the elephants moving around in the way that you're describing. And this guy, I don't know how naive he thought everybody else that he was talking to was, but said, well, yeah, they're dancing. They're just happy and they're just dancing along with the music. Yeah. And I thought, oh, yeah. My God, that's trying super hard there, pal, but good luck with that. But So anyways, before, I want to make sure we don't run out of time. So the key thing, I think, about this was not only the basic idea, but something you just mentioned, which is then you went from, like, showing it in that screening room and where, maybe other places. But how and when did you decide, I'm going to project this video piece on buildings outside?
Well, it was, I received a grant from the Department of Cultural Affairs in Chicago, and their mission was to bring art out into the neighborhoods. And so I proposed, of Chicago, and I proposed to do an installation at this armory where they had basketball, it's a gymnasium, gymnastics for kids and cooking classes, senior center, very vibrant area. It's not the greatest, like the parking lot has the police lights because there's drug dealing in the parking lot. It's notorious. So there's a lot happening right there. And so I was going to do it inside, but then I was driving past and I thought, it's going to look kind of swallowed up inside this huge armory. And I thought, what if I do it outside? And that is where the seed happened, where I was like, okay, that's a good idea. And I saw in doing, I mean, it was, I didn't realize how difficult it is because you can't just use a regular projector. So I kind of was in over my head for a minute.
Yeah.
And I figured it out. And then I did it for a night. It actually was four nights, but it was announced and people came and the news came. And was really, I saw the potential of doing this, of projecting onto this public space and surprising people, and what are you doing, and so much conversation can happen.
Yeah,
that was the beginning.
Right. So when people are watching that, and again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I mean, you projected this, I guess, 100 some odd times throughout this country, but in other countries as well. So I don't know if you're always there when it's being projected, but to what extent, I know that sometimes you're able to speak with bystanders, I don't know if that's always the case, but to what extent can you kind of get a sense of what their reaction is to what they're seeing? I mean, relative to what they actually are seeing.
Well, I think people get it pretty quickly. I mean, some people are just surprised. Like, there's this range of people saying, oh, if they're going by quickly, they'll just look at it. And I mean, I like that even happens, that somebody's just seeing something, they don't know what it is, and they just keep going. But maybe it makes them think or changes their day. Just something interesting, and how numb can we be in our day-to-day life? There's that element of it. But then there's people who get it. They just look at it because there's an identification. I mean, people see this rocking, and you see one after the other. And I think that suffering is, we can identify with it. And also it's graceful. You know, how do we rock our babies, the prayer rocking. This is sort of this behavior of soothing. And so people can see that not only the suffering, but also see the striving to soothe ourselves. So,
yeah.
For instance, people stop and they do get it. They say, what are we doing? This is terrible. You know, this guy got out of his car the very first time, that one in Broadway Armory. He looks at the wall and he looks at me and he says, man, we are messed up. He used a different word.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
we laugh, you know. And then, so it sometimes lots of people come passing by. Sometimes I have flyers now that I can hand out to people so that they know what it's about.
Okay. Because I was wondering. Go ahead.
Well, that I found was one of the difficulties of the project is that I could only talk to a limited number of people.
Right.
And then there's this hope that they watch, or it's kind of a gesture and a hope that through seeing this, there's some information is transferred.
And so before I knew, that you had things that you could hand out, one of the questions I can ask, I was just curious about how much of the meaning or impact seems different depending on the locale, like how my Chicago people differ from New York people, differ from Paris or Reykjavik people, or has it been fairly consistent?
It's pretty universal. I mean, yeah. I think in Paris, people were really, like, you know, jumping in and people like to take loads of selfies and pictures and they interact with it. They go into the projection.
Yeah.
So there's the play, but pretty much I have found that it's universal. It's like people understand and they want to, some people like to talk, some people want to engage, you know,
just
in Reykjavik, you know, I was on a residential street and I asked the homeowner, I said, hey, can I project on your house? They came out. It was so lucky. I thought that would be a good house. And then they came out and I said, oh, hey, can I project this video? I told them about it. And she said, sure. So it was a good spot because people were coming and going and there were people from around the world just passing that street and people from Germany, people from China. And I talked to these people from Frankfurt for a long time. We had such a good time. They were like, what's happening in the United States? It was right after the election.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could talk. It was, and they, most people get it. It's
okay.
Kind of funny. Like, how do zoos keep existing if so many people get it? I don't know.
So, are you still, I wasn't clear if you're still showing that piece or is
I
that?
Am.
Yeah, okay. Because I was curious because it seemed like something I read, maybe I didn't read far enough, seemed like there was within a year or two, maybe I hadn't seen references to further installations. Because I was just wondering if, in your view, a piece, even like 30 times a minute, has any kind of a shelf life in particular, or if that just can and should be shown as long as there's opportunities to do so. Yeah.
I think I just was showing it in Port Collins at CSU, Colorado State University.
Yeah.
Summer, and I was just in LA projecting, but I am making new work about a polar bear, and I'm also doing I'm doing more animals now.
Okay.
You know, I have a projection on the 15th at Loyola, and I'll be showing pacing tigers and polar bears and other animals. So I'm not doing as much, but I'm working on a book of all of the photographs. So that book will be published by Radius Book, and it's coming out next year.
Oh, great.
And it's this great lineup of authors contributing essays. And
oh, great.
This book now, you know, I have all of these locations, and the book can be used as a platform to share the message of Stephen Wise from the Non-Human Rights Project is going to write something. And so we need all the awareness spread as far and wide as we can.
Unfortunately, we're just at this point out of time, but I was going to actually bring up the Non-Human Rights Project just because just one measure of the influence of art or how influential at least it can be at times was where, in this case, 30 times a minute intersected with policy or attempted policy. The Non-Human Rights Project, we've had Stephen Wise on the show, is, of course, an organization who's made a bid to have the legal system deem animals to have rights, to have an elephant or a chimp viewed as persons or personhood. And I think they've really dovetailed their efforts and your efforts in some ways have supported each other.
Yes. Yeah. I think there's a lot of potential to collaborate.
So, anyways, well, great. Well, we'll keep track of all the new work, the polar bear thing and the book in the works. So this has been great. So we've been speaking with Colleen Plum. Again, the website is Colleen Plum. It's Colleen Plum, PLUMB.com. And find out all about her work and other things we've talked about and see installations and pieces of stuff we discussed, including 30 times a minute, et cetera. So Colleen, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your show. It's such a great show. I'm honored to be part of it.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. In a few moments, I'll speak with Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice about Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover piece exploring what appears to be a drastic decline in the insect population worldwide. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is a vintage piece by Ellen DeGeneres, a fitting prelude to our conversation with Dr. Spicer Rice. And Ellen, by the way, has a brand new Netflix special coming out in a couple weeks' time. But anyways, this piece today is part of a larger piece called Nature and Insects by Ellen DeGeneres in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I'm fascinated by animals. All of nature, really. All of nature fascinates me. You ever watch ants? You have that kind of time, like me? It's for a while there. You know, it's interesting because if you watch them, they're always in that one long single file line. If you notice that, they're always in that one single file line. They don't have to be. There are no lanes painted for them that they're forced to stay in. They can go anywhere on the ground that they want to go, but they stay in that line. I think, don't you think there's got to be that one ant, that one asshole ant in the back, just filled with road rage back there, just come on! You ever notice sometimes an ant will pick up a dead ant and walk around with that dead ant carrying that around? That's to get into the carpool lane to pass up that line. I'm pretty sure. And we kill them like crazy.
That was Ellen DeGeneres with a portion of a piece called Nature and Insects, taken from one of her stand-up appearances back in the day. Now it's time to speak with Dr. Spicer Rice about that New York Times Magazine cover story. This is Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Spicer Rice.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we loved you. We love having you on. And when I read this big New York Times Sunday Magazine cover piece, I thought, well, we gotta get her expertise involved with this. So first of all, given how big and extensively reported the story was there word in the entomology circles that this story was kind of in the works?
We've heard a little bit about it. I didn't understand the scope of it until it came out. And then after it came out, I'm so thrilled to hear and to see that people have been reading it and thinking about it. It's just wonderful.
And so give me your overall reaction, both the fundamental premise of the story and how you feel that premise was supported.
Okay, great. Well, the premise of the story is basically outlining how insects across the world are dying and or just being gone in general, and how a lot of them are becoming extinct and some of them are going missing, and how we need to start paying attention and hopefully start working to rebuild populations and to at least pay attention to what's going away before we lose it. And my impression is that it's great. I think Brooke Jarvis did a wonderful job of synthesizing this information that probably every entomologist or naturalist notices and worries about on a local level, but she placed it in a global context so that we can all see that what we've been seeing in our own backyards is actually happening everywhere.
And because it was placed in a global context, did that make you more concerned about the things that maybe were more immediately in your sphere, just saying, oh my God, this really is happening in Copenhagen or wherever else the report included? So did that give you kind of greater concern or only sort of confirm what your suspicions had been?
It basically just confirmed my suspicion.
Yeah.
But I hope that it gives a lot of us other people greater concern and maybe helps people to start paying attention to insects and not being so afraid of them.
And how big of a role do you think that plays? Because certainly it seemed like there was key cause that some people still somehow managed to deny exists, was climate change, which seemed like a substantial factor in this.
It's true. Climate change is a substantial factor, and I understand that some people still feel nervous and understanding that climate change is directly attributable to humans, but it just is. And we can document that, and it has been documented across the world and across many different levels of the world. But also, you cannot deny that habitat loss is another major factor. When is the last time that we've seen meadows or giant forests? A lot of times when we go out into nature, it's from manufactured experiences where we are going to the woods, not that we are, you know, that it just happens to be right next door. Because humans are really good at expanding into these new environments and taking over these natural areas without realizing what we're doing.
First of all, if you're going to try to make a bunch of sense about climate change being sort of man-made or whatever, we're going to have to end our conversation here. You can't be part of our Trump-oriented administration if you're going to make that kind of sense. But all kidding aside, you made a huge important point, because one of the things the story really talks about is that there are so many factors, and some of these things just necessarily, given the scope, involve incomplete information that you just can't really research the full extent of some of these things because it's just too mammoth, too sprawling.
It's too sprawling, and we don't have records from a long time ago. And so this is another thing that's important to us that is related to climate change and to, or whatever we would like to call things, but it's about humans. So a lot of people, I study ants, so a lot of people ask me, what good do they do, right? And that's a lot of times we think of everything as having this purpose for good on the earth, and that the purpose is to serve humans and do good for humans. And so I think a lot of us scratch our heads as ecologists and entomologists and try to think of what good, you know, how is this ant going to cure cancer or something?
Yeah.
But the truth is that the environment is extremely complicated.
Yeah.
And that an ecosystem is a very tangled web. And if we pull something out of the ecosystem 5 miles down the web, we might not realize that that pulling away is going to impact us far away, because there are a lot of factors that go in between.
Yeah.
So even if it doesn't impact us directly now, it will impact us in other ways, or could impact us in other ways. And the truth is, the amount of stuff that we don't know about how things work is so vast. On one hand, it's beautiful, but on the other hand, it's scary. Can I give an example of...
Well, we're just about out of time. If you can do it in like 15, 20 seconds, I'm sorry to say that we're just about out of time otherwise.
How about this? We brought a beetle in here. We didn't think about how it was going to... We had an invasive species of beetle come in. It killed 100 million trees in areas where we've taken out the natural enemy. And human death from cardiovascular disease in those areas skyrocketed. And we didn't think about the good that those creatures were doing in those trees that we eliminated before the beetles came in that could take them away. Does that help?
That puts it in, I think, stark reality. And I wish we had more time. Maybe we'll have you on again to talk more about this. But thank you so much for joining us again on Talking Animals, Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. It's Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next after NPR News.